This time on the show, Arthur, Prince of Gemworld,
maintaining your character's integrity,
and girls play Pokemon differently. All this and more on Comics Are Great. Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show, recorded live on Wednesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time at the Ann Arbor District Library, comics.aadl.org, right on the corner of 5th and William in lovely downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan. My name is Jersey Drozd, and I'm a cartoonist and teaching artist, and this is the show where we talk about comics, comic storytelling, comics lifestyle, making stories visually. And to my right, I have the man who has the corner office on the sad life of being a comics writer, Mr. Paul Story.
That would be me. because I post on Twitter and Facebook apparently all the time how sad I am.
You're sad, man.
At He's least got according
that,
to Jersey.
That hangdog expression, the sad puppy eyes. You're like Paul from the Beatles, right?
I'm the good-looking one.
Yes, the cute one with the sad eyes. Yeah. But yes, he's ever to my right, Mr. Paul Story of Storyville.com. Thanks again for being here, Paul.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks for being my wingman. I'm going to need you today because I'm suffering from a cold, as everybody can hear.
Yes, so people are going to be forced to listen to me talking. Thankfully, we have two great guests.
Yes, they will not have to suffer you for long because we also have the man who coined the name of this show on the show, Dan Mishkin. Of facebook.com/Dan Mishkin, right?
Yay!
Perfectly by accident. It just kind of happened.
Well, you haven't been on since episode one, so do we want to tell that story real quick? But first, we should say that Dan Mishkin is the co-creator of some very well-known and popular comics, Amethyst, Princess of Gemworld, co-creator of Blue Devil. Wrote Superman, Wonder Woman.
Yeah, Creeps with Creeps. Tom Creeps. Exciting yes. Horror humor heroes.
Spell Game.
Spellgame. I forgot all about Spellgame.
Spellgame, which you worked on with
Ramon Perez was the artist.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, one of the legends of our time. Yeah, for sure. So, what's the story about the Comics Are Great name that you came up with?
I'll just tell the short version was when we were attending an event that you were on a panel, people talking about doing comics. One of the panelists was somebody who said, well, I really wanted to make a movie, but that's really expensive and it's hard to do. So I did comics instead as sort of my fallback. And I was quietly fuming at that remark. And afterward, I came up to you and said, basically, who let that woman on the dais there? I mean, what's going on? I said, you do not have to justify comics as a means of getting into doing movies. Comics don't have to be anything other than what they are because comics are great.
Yeah, and the way you said it, though, is I watched this over 30-year-old man devolve into an 8-year-old boy when he was saying this. It was like this cheerful, explosive enthusiasm. I think comics are great.
And yeah, I don't remember that was my affect, but I could well imagine.
Yeah,
it
was.
Thankfully, he didn't go for comics are great.
No.
I'm in love with comics. I mean, that's
he is.
Comics changed my life. I was 5 years old. I have an older brother who brought home an issue of Sheldon Mayer's Sugar and Spike, and I opened up that comic, and my life completely changed.
That explains a lot.
Really, I tell people sometimes it's like the Wizard of Oz going from black and white to color. That's the kind of change that occurred in my life by opening my first comic book. There's a whole world.
And I really wish, Dan, that you would rent yourself out as a comics buddy to talk with people about comics. Anybody who's ever experienced the sad despair that Paul Story always talks about on Twitter, the loneliness and isolation that comes from being a cartoonist, and you wonder, why should I even do this? Why should I go on? Just talk to Dan Mishkin for 5 minutes, and you're going to want to punch dinosaurs in the mouth because that's how excited this guy is about comics. So I'm excited to have you here. But I don't want to take any more time before we have another guest yet.
Yes.
Big roundtable today, and this is exciting to me because we got Brianne Druhard on the show. Thankfully, Skype is still working. She's still with us. Brianne,
I can still I can still see Dan, but it's just a frozen picture.
Oh.
No, that's just Dan.
You guys are moving, so.
Dan got Botox recently.
Andrew Hart of PotatoFarmGirl.blogspot.com. Let's see. Let's go through some of your credits. You are an animator, storyboard artist, character designer, worked on such popular things as Teen Titans Go, Transformers Animated, and I think anybody who's been a longtime listener of the show knows where I stand on that particular animated series.
Were you going to get to Batman the Brave and the Bold?
Batman the Brave and the Bold, the best iteration of the Batman cartoon franchise, in my opinion, so far.
Well, that does not surprise me.
Yeah, it's finally getting back to when Batman was fun to watch. For crying out loud. So, yeah, you're involved in a lot of really fun stuff, and your stuff is gorgeous to look at. Also, we should mention BillyTheUnicorn.com.
Oh, yeah.
So tell us about this. I mean, this is one of your, you know, this is not an animation project. This is an ebook project.
Oh, Billy. Yeah. It didn't start out as an ebook. I was approached at Comic-Con. I did a panel on children's books with some friends. And MoBad, the company that put out the ebook, came up to me and they're like, we would like to make it interactive. So that's kind of how that happened. And luckily, I'm not exactly sure who the whole team was, but the girl who approached me, I think she was one of the lead, artists or animators on the project. So she put a lot of, work and love into that. Because I actually didn't have any time to give them any new artwork because I was working on, DC Nation stuff on the side. Yeah. So I kind of was like, I'm sorry. And I got the app and everything is alive in there. I still find stuff I didn't know that she had animated.
Wow.
You run your finger over the trees and birds come out or there's robots hiding in there and just
super
amazing.
Cool. Nice. And it's really pretty to boot. I mean, it's very, very, it's easy on the eyes. But we should also say that you are also, and I don't know how much we can talk about this, Brianne, but you're an Amethyst fan as well. Yeah?
Yeah. I wish I could ask so many questions, and I'm afraid to,
He's mostly harmless. He really is.
I know. I'm more worried about other people being I don't know. But I am a fan, and I'm very humbled and hoping that, I do something that at least helps the character. And
I am so looking forward to what you're going to be doing on Amethyst. I'm thrilled. So, yeah, I'm expecting to become an Amethyst fan.
Well,
yeah, he's downright giddy.
We can say this,
that if you go to potatofarmgirl.blogspot.com, there's some stuff on there that refers to something to do with Amethyst. How about we we're being coy. It's not to drive traffic to your blog spot, Brianne, but
although that doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt. But
you can also go on YouTube and just Google Amethyst Gemerald and something will pop up. So,
I got so many at tweets from people when that video went live, saying, "Jersey, did you hear?" Because one of the things that I do is whenever I go to comic conventions, I go to the back issue bins and I try to grab as many copies of this maxi series as possible, because I think it truly is one of the finest examples of comic storytelling in the 20th century, and I try to give it to everybody who will take it. And Dan's
that's no pressure on Dan at all.
Well, and let's give credit where credit's due. A lot of this has to do with Ernie Colone.
Let's give Ernie Colone plenty of credit, please.
I use examples from this book in all of my comics classrooms, and I push it on every cartoonist that I can find to say, look, study this. This is a postgraduate course on comic storytelling, this book. So
the artwork in that is just gorgeous. So, I mean, I'm glad they're reprinting it finally.
Yeah.
I'm in black and white, but that's okay.
Well, it'll of course, nice. At least Ernie's work looks great in black and white. I mean,
yeah, Ernie's great. I wish that he had done the entire series on scratchboard the way he did the preview. Mm-hmm. But I think there were issues in trying to maintain that. And the stuff he did, he established a look with the scratchboard work, and then he was able to pretty much replicate a lot of that when he went on to do the Maxi series. But man, his stuff is just great. His storytelling is so good. He can pack so much story onto a page, and he's thinking about the characters. As I've told Jersey, one of the really interesting contributions that Ernie made was writing dialogue, actually obscene dialogue, on the boards, that of course none of it could be kept, partly sometimes because it had nothing to do with the story, but it actually showed me and Gary a lot more about who the characters were in Ernie's mind and what we could do with them. So he was drawing them in a particular way. He did the thing with the little clasp on Dark Opal's cloak that would change its facial expression to match Dark Opal's own expression. Mm-hmm. And he would really give these characters individual personalities that also came out in this obscene dialogue that then provided a lot of useful information for us. He's great. Ernie's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. I honestly suspect he's not of this world. He's so good at what he does. He's the only cartoonist that I would give that attribution to, actually. But anyway, so we're getting to our topic here. We got a topic that we want to discuss at the roundtable. Yeah. So Amethyst Princess of Gemworld, why is it that a 12-year-old boy was able to pick up this book and go, oh my gosh, this is so good? Because, man, Dan, you're writing stories for girls, after all. And, girls
don't... You're very in touch with your feminine side.
We won't get into my J. Edgar Hoover stuff until later on, the second part of the
show. I wasn't quite going there, but okay.
But you know, it's like girls don't read comics, so obviously you must have done something where you tricked little boys into reading about girls through action-adventure stories, right? I mean... Writing adventure stories for girls, how do you do it? There's got to be some kind of trick, some kind of secret sauce, some kind of magic thing that you do.
Well, it's got magic in it.
Oh, there you go.
So well, you know, as I mentioned to you, Jersey, you and Brienne, just recently, I'm very aware of having tried to do a trick like that when I was writing Wonder Woman. But in writing Amethyst, it just was the story that we were... telling, I mean, the first question I have is, why did DC decide to publish it? I mean, I really don't know and think that they could sell something like that in 1982. In fact, Gary and I were just asked to come up with like an 8-page-a-month continuing series in a in one of the mystery comics, the House of Mystery or Tales of the Unexpected or something like that. And we came up with Amethyst. I think it must have been Jeanette Kahn who saw it and said, girl stuff. Jeanette really was all about, well, not all about, because she really understood the traditional boy superhero stuff. But when she could promote girl stuff, she did. But what we did to make it girl friendly, I think it was about believing in what the project was. You know, this is Amethyst, Princess of Gemworld. Start with that, and you'll get a girl comic. And it's when you fight that you have problems.
I want to hear from a reader's standpoint. I want to hear from Brienne, because I mean, growing up a fan of the comic, what was it about this particular story that you gravitated towards?
I've always kind of been into the whole fantasy world stuff. I mean, I guess like very superficial level, like I love fairies, elves, unicorns, all that stuff. But I also like characters that are brave and basically can solve their own problems. I think Amethyst, Amy Winston, like, it's kind of interesting because she goes to Gemworld and it's like all these royals and things, they don't know how, I don't know, maybe because they're so used to relying on magic or something. Like, she ends up kind of helping everybody. And, like, she's got these magical powers, but a lot of it comes from, like, growing up on Earth and just using her smarts. And it's not all about like makeup or boys. I mean, it is a part of a girl's life. I mean, it's fine to have that stuff, but when it's just that, it gets really boring and it feels forced and fake. So, I mean, the fact that like she's dealing with other things, you know, and just, you know, she's just doing the best she can. I mean, I don't know. That's just something you can kind of relate to. You know, there's a struggle. Sorry.
Yeah. No, you know, I think one of the things that you're saying, Brianne, also is she doesn't become a fantasy novel character who is sort of in the same way that our Blue Devil character doesn't slip right into the conventions of what a superhero is supposed to be, do, think, etc. Amy doesn't slip into like some, well, I've read Tolkien, therefore I know exactly what I'm supposed to do here kind of thing. She complains even about, in some ways, maybe only implicitly, about being a princess. She's an American, you know, all men are created equal type person. So how does somebody get to be a princess? So she does take, you know, real world, real self, real girl in America to the gem world, rather than being completely transformed into Amethyst Princess of Gem World.
Could the story have been told, you know, Arnold, Prince of Gem World?
Well, my favorite version was Ambergris, Princess of Sperm Whale, but that's a very bad pun.
I'll agree with
look,
that. Yeah.
Could you do a boy who discovers that he secretly is the heir to great power and a savior that others have been waiting for? Well, yeah, ask J.K. Rowling. Yes, you can.
It sounds outlandish to me. I don't know.
This particular story, you know, it's funny. One of the things that I semi feel bad about or semi regret with regard to Amethyst is the extent to which I think she spends too long being acted upon rather than really proactive.
Mm-hmm.
So I really hate to say this, but I think that with a boy character, we would have got him up to speed maybe more quickly. So, like I say, it's kind of a regret. On the other hand, it does describe some of what's good about the series, too. Going back to that whole, you don't immediately become a fantasy hero thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of stereotypical to do it that way, but it is a valid and really interesting and potentially captivating way of presenting a child coming into that kind of world.
I mean, that was one thing I did like about the comic is that she grows as she goes along. She becomes more interesting. And, I mean, as far as, you know, you said it took you longer to get to where you wanted to in the comic.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this isn't a secret now because, like, DC Nation already aired, but you guys know how long the shorts are, right? They're a minute.
They're like short shorts, right.
Yeah, and I know Lauren Faust in her Eye on Eye article or her interview for SDFS, I know she mentioned like how you have this limited amount of time. She couldn't fit everything she wanted in her shorts, but she did a really amazing job with the time that she was given. I think with the Amethyst short, because we don't have a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
We had to work out some stuff just to get to, like, you know, point A to point B. How can we get here? How can we still have show personality in the character? You know, I mean, sorry, I'm like stuttering.
No, it's a real problem. And even though I said, gosh, it took us a while to go where we meant to go, we were told we had 12 issues, mm-hmm. and that was it. Because although DC was oddly agreeing to do this girl comic, they said, we can't really imagine that it's going to last. So tell your story in 12 issues. Mm. So, yeah, we were also, you know, constrained in that way. But constraints, you know, are wonderful. Comics are, in many ways, very constraining. because of the size of the page, the need to do dialogue that doesn't totally interfere with the visual storytelling. You are hemmed in from the get-go, and yet you can be liberated by that. That's one of the things I really love about doing comics, is that it has that strange find liberation in constraint aspect to it.
I used
do it in a minute. You can do lots of things in a minute. You can win basketball games, I'm told. But,
exactly. There's a lot you can. I'm kind of amazed how much stuff we were able to get in or sneak in. You can like layer things. You know, you can have something going on in the background, or just like maybe just a hint of something. And hopefully, it's enough. Like when the comic gets re-released and people pick it up, they'll be like, "Oh, that's referencing that or something." You know, like. You know, I mean, there's things that, you know, we had to kind of obviously gloss over, or we didn't even have time to touch on, but hopefully it's enough of a gateway drug that they'll be like, I have to pick up this book, and like, oh, I wish we could have seen this happen, but there wasn't enough time, but I get to read about it.
What were you going to add, Paul?
Oh, I was just, I was thinking about what Dan was saying about the constraints of comics. I used to get... a lot of people, when I was doing the DC Animated Universe comics, the Batman Beyond, Justice League Unlimited, and Gotham Girls, I used to get people going like, whoa, doesn't it really, you know, make you, you know, isn't it tough having to work in those constraints? And I'm like, they're part of the, you know, no matter what you're doing, you've got some guidelines. And if you know... you know, what you're working with, hopefully you're coming up with a story that fits it. You know, that you're not, as the example I used to use, which is funny because I don't do sports, but it's, I always said, like, if I want to show what a great boxer I am, I don't do it on a basketball court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was the idea that people are like, oh, well, you know, don't you want to show more mature themes and things? And I thought, not here. I mean, or at least not overt or... graphic stuff. That's not what I'm trying to get here.
Or like promoting like a cynical outlook, right? You can't fight City Hall kids, so don't even try.
Yeah,
the
that's
end.
The end. Oh, life is yeah. Life is despair. Give in.
That was in the Amethyst Annual, actually. But I want to ask this. Okay, so you're talking about SBFF, which is it? What's the full title of the series that's coming out?
She's close to that. It's Super Best Friends Forever.
Ah. There's been some art that's been passed around, Lauren Faust style, Supergirl, Batgirl, and Wonder Girl, right?
Yeah.
They look amazing. It looks like it's going to be an incredible show. I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, I don't identify myself as a brony, but I am a fan of the My Little Pony Friendship is Magic show. Yeah. I think it's fantastic. But
hey, maybe now we'll. Oh, we got Batgirl on a cartoon again. Maybe we'll get some Gotham Girls to finally be.
Yeah, maybe some Gotham Girls.
Dan, you give me hope. Amethyst is finally coming out. I think another 15 years. You know, they could re-release Gotham Girls.
That's okay. That's
I don't know what the future holds, but if DC Nation does well enough, maybe. Who knows? Maybe DC or Cartoon Network will be like, give us more, and then maybe we can branch out farther.
How amazing would it be?
Saturday morning.
How fantastic would it be if DC started making lots and lots of comics for kids? Oh man, that would be incredible. But I know they make some. Don't get me started.
I was just going to say that's craziness.
Yeah, I know. Because kids don't read comics either. Women don't read comics. Kids don't read comics.
And girl children? No.
Not those girl children.
Children don't read comics.
I want to dig at this because this is interesting. Somebody is bound to say, well, gee, boy, girl, doesn't matter. Just write a good story and the audience will gather around. Like Harry Potter, boys and girls both like it. But come on, super Best Friends Forever. That's aimed at girls. It's got to be. Look at it, right? That's not aimed at the guy with the sloppy Joe in his hand and then the copy of Maxim in the other hand.
It's in good hands. Like she did post on DeviantArt, so I hopefully like won't get in trouble. But I did a storyboard for her for SBFF.
Uh huh.
So yay. I like yeah. It's just it's fun, it's goofy, and I don't think you have to be a girl to watch it. It's definitely like, if there's a guy that like My Little Pony, they'll probably like SBFF too. It's not like I said, the whole thing where like girls do their hair and makeup all day, like, I don't think that's going to be the main theme of SBFF. I mean, they're superheroes. They go and punch people and save people and...
Right,
right.
You know, and they work together. So I don't know. I'm looking forward to when those finally start airing soon. So,
well, Eli Nyberger's in the chat, and he says, My Little Pony shows that aimed at girls, in air quotes, is no longer a deterrent to boys if it's a good show. And totally agree. Yeah. But what I was driving at there, what I think is an interesting question is, knowing that it's aimed at girls, how do you aim at girls? Right? Like, what are you thinking? What's your thinking process when you say, like, I want to aim this at girls. What am I going to put in it? Oh, well, obviously, I got to put in lipstick and fashion and, you know, pretty high heels and the cute boy with the swooshy blonde thing in front of his hair, right?
Alan M. from Josie and the Pussycats.
Yeah, yeah. Or, yeah. So, I mean, like, I'm wondering if we can put our finger on a few of the kind of thinking process that we go through when we're saying this needs to be aimed at girls, or am I asking a very dangerous question?
I don't think so. But I think it's simpler than, well, for me, I think, I mean, maybe I'm just naive, but I think the trick is to treat girls like a human. It's a person. You treat them the same way like boys. Like, I mean, we're all people. We all enjoy the similar things in life. I mean, that comes first.
Right.
I mean, I think that's the mindset you have to have. I think that's probably one of the reasons Tony's done well. And I mean, I've pitched a couple of things to networks, and I've had people straight up tell me, we don't want girl stuff. We don't want a female lead. And they'll be like, well, we want you to focus on the side character because he's a boy. And it's not like because they hate girls or anything. It's mostly, and this is kind of weird. It's kind of sad that it all comes back to merchandise or toys, because they don't think girls like action figures or toys. Like, it's just strange.
So you're saying girls don't like dolls?
No. Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. And like, I don't. It's confusing to me. I mean, and the other thing too is like, why would you market to only half the world? You don't like money, you don't want both, you know. But
well, you know, I mean, culturally, there's a very clear thing. There's let me speak as a white male for a second, but a white non-Christian male, so maybe I get a little something here. If the standard of person is white Christian male, which in many ways it is in our society, then females will read about males, but males won't read about females.
Yeah.
Minority races will read about white heroes, but not, or, you know, you'll, plenty of black people watch white TV, not nearly so many white people watch black TV, right? All these white bread Clark Kent, Bruce Wayne characters were created by Jews, you know, like me, right? And Jews will read about the M1 standard white male Christian, but there are maybe fewer of the majority folks who are going to be interested in the other. So it's not appealing to half. It's based on an assumption that the half that has power, the half that counts, will, if the stories are told about them, then the other half is just going to have to pull themselves along, and they're going to accept that that's the society they live in, and that's, they're going to have to make that their story too.
I think that's interesting, because Scott McCloud talks about how, in Understanding Comics, and especially in manga, how they go very generic with the appearance to try and make it more universal, to make it they over sometimes even oversimplify to try and make it easier for somebody to kind of pop themselves in. And I just was thinking that idea that, you know, that there's a default of, mm-hmm. you know, wasp male, like, then people tend to think of that as generic.
Right.
You know, like, oh, well, everybody can project onto that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, I mean, it's kind of crazy, but I think that's interesting.
Everybody that, should be me for a day.
No, it's just everybody
but, you know,
can understand.
And that's business. It doesn't answer Jersey's question. If you're going to tell a story about girls, hopefully for girls, what do you do? If you assume that somebody may buy it, like Jersey and I, in fact, are developing a project now.
That's pretty much
all girls.
Yep.
And, you know, we've got an agent who thinks he can sell it for some reason, but...
Whoa, are we allowed to say that?
That you think you can sell it?
I'm not giving any names. We're working on a project.
Okay, yeah. Okay. That's cool.
Aren't we allowed to say... Well,
maybe you should get Brianne to do covers.
I'm not naming names.
What's that, Brianne?
I said, if you need anything from me, let me know.
Oh man, done and done. So
I'm a facilitator.
We're a long way. We're only at the beginning of talking about this project. But you know, when I think about what we're going to do with this, and when I think about how I worked on Amethyst and Wonder Woman, you know, the starting point is they have to be real characters.
Yeah.
You know, when I was talking before about Amethyst not becoming your standard fantasy character, but remaining Amy Winston, girl from slightly upstate New York. They have to be who they are. That kind of integrity. And, you know, my Wonder Woman was, I don't know, she was a girl whose mother didn't like her boyfriend. You know, that was a big part of Wonder Woman, the dynamic, the kind of character dynamic of what I was doing with Wonder Woman. Part of making that work was to solve the Steve Trevor problem, which I paid a lot of attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm told by people that they thought I did a good job. But, you know, my model for that was Modesty Blaze and Willie Garvin. If you know the Modesty Blaze story, right? And
bring listeners up to speed on that.
Yeah, so, you know, Modesty Blaze, a comic strip, also novels, also very odd movie in the 1960s.
Very odd movie.
With Verna Lisi as Modesty Blaze, I believe. Anyhow, the
was it Terrence so Howard as Willie?
What's that?
Wasn't it Terrence? What's his Zod? Wasn't he Willie?
Terrence Stamp? He might have been in that.
I think he was Willie Garvin.
I only know him as Chancellor Valorum. Thank you very much.
Oh, sorry.
Much.
Anyway, sorry, Dan. I didn't mean to derail.
So Modesty Blaze, she's, you know, that was around for years and years and years. So she starts out as kind of a displaced person, war orphan, who then, she's an operative. She's, you know, spy, thief, thriller, savior sort of person. And she's the star. She is mysterious. She is sexy. She is smart. She is strong, powerful. And her sidekick is this hunk of a guy, Willie Garvin. And there's never any question that Modesty is the star and Willie is the sidekick. But they're fully realized people. It's not a big deal that she's the leader, you know, and he's the follower. And, you know, that makes... So I think that one of the things that people might do if they're going to have a strong woman is to say that, well, that means the men have to be weak.
That's this really sexist, automatic
idea that people have. If you avoid that, if you avoid making Steve Trevor, in the case of Wonder Woman... a guy who is emasculated, because if he's with a strong woman, he's got to feel emasculated. Yeah. But if you say, what? That doesn't make sense. Then you can actually do some interesting things. So for me, it was important to work on Steve so that he'd be a strong, solid character that the boy readers were going to care about. But in fact, I think the goal was that they're all characters you care about because you relate to them, because you understand them.
Well, let's talk about Teen Titans for a second, because Brianne worked on that, and there was that big kerfuffle, 6 months ago or whatever?
No.
With the whole Starfire thing.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
That was just trying to make her more alien.
They were just trying to make her a stronger character because she kissed whatever boy she wanted to whenever she wanted to, and there were no repercussions. And then there was that article that somebody posted where their 7-year-old daughter was reading the comic, and she was a fan of the Teen Titans cartoon, and she didn't understand why Starfire wasn't actually doing anything. And anyway, it's all old story. But what I wanted to go is let's talk about Starfire as a character in Teen Titans, the cartoon, right? Very strong character, but also a character who is full of emotion, very sweet.
Very excitable.
Very excitable, yeah, right?
I have to say, like, I actually don't have a favorite Teen Titans character from the show. I actually love all of them, but she's always the one I gravitate towards drawing because she is so emotional. Like, she's got all these broad movements. I mean, I wish we would have had time to do more of an arc with her or something. Like, I would love to have seen, like, her and her sister, like, breaking out of space prison or something. Like, just ripping things apart. But, yeah, that actually reminds me. I spoke at a character design class at CalArts a month or two ago, and that Starfire, the DC Starfire thing came up. And when I went to college there, probably been about 10 years, there was about 5 of us girls in our animation class out of like 70 guys. But to the character design class, it was mostly girls. And the Starfire thing came up. They all read comics. And the second one of them mentioned Starfire, there was like fire and flames. Girls were so like, what did they do to her? And I was like, oh, calm down. Yeah. You know, we'll... hopefully, you know, things will change or something.
Plus,
but...
and the DVDs are still there, and a lot of issues of Teen Titans Go and collections of Teen Titans Go are still there. So,
but interesting that Brianne brought up the fact that you don't have a favorite Teen Titan. Why is that? Because all of the characters are interesting and compelling in their own way, right? So, like, Raven is not the girl we're supposed to... It's like, this is something I teach in my comics classes, and this is something I picked up from working with Dan over the years in a teaching capacity, is you don't put a character up on the stage just to be booed at. You, if you're writing, one of the terms that Dan taught me that I'm really grateful for is emotional honesty with your characters, and not just, like, being honest with your own emotions as an author, but having a real empathy for every character on the stage and giving them a reason to do what they do so that the readers will care. This guy doesn't just, even if it's a guy that's just there to be a bad guy, at least make him endearing and engaging in some way or another, right?
That was actually a problem I ran into with Gotham Girls, because 3 out of 4 issues were villains.
Yeah.
And each issue focused on the villain or you know, the individual character. So they still had to be bad, but you still had to feel, you know, identify with them or feel bad for them or, you know, have a sense of that it's not just, oh, well, you know, Catwoman is Catwoman because she wants to, you know, she wants to steal things, or Poison Ivy wants to kill people, or Harley Quinn's just cuckoo crazy.
She likes to hit things with a big hammer.
Yeah, there had to be more. Yeah. And, you know, I kind of explored that by doing little flashbacks with their origins and stuff. But you know, you had to try and bring a certain amount of humanity and sympathy to these characters who are, are technically the people, like you say, you're supposed to boo.
I want to get Dan Mishkin's input on this in a second, but first I want to hear from Brianne, because when we talk about the Teen Titans, and I just want to see if you can maybe map a little bit in a broad sense, what do you do to get into, like, you talked about Starfire and her expansive gestures. So when Starfire feels something, she really feels it, right? She's not just happy. She's like Starfire happy. And if she's enjoying ice cream, she's enjoying it only as Starfire can. Can you describe for any, you know, we got a lot of people who listen to the show who want to be cartoonists, want to be visual storytellers. Could you maybe describe the process of getting into those characters? How do you get inside those characters and empathize with them to understand how Starfire's body language is going to be different than Raven's?
Well, I mean, I guess to give credit where credit's due, like, I didn't set that up originally. Like, I started season 2 on Titans. Like, Glenn Miracomi and the writers, like David Slack and Rob Hoagie and Amy Wolfram.
I was going to say, you work with Amy, didn't you?
Yes.
I got to meet Amy a couple of times out at out at Comic-Con, and she's good
her.
Friends with people I know. So, yeah. Cool. Sorry.
I love with her. I love her. I always end up working with her off and on different things. So, yeah. They were the ones who set up the personalities for the characters. So when I started, like, Raven was already an introvert. Like, Raven has to keep control of her emotions because if she, like, her and Starfire are kind of a foil for each other a little bit in that way. So, I mean, it is, like, I do take into consideration the personality of the character before I draw it. I mean, when we do designs for animation, at least the way I was told to do it for TV, we don't usually put them in a lot of poses because we want overseas to go off of the storyboards and emote. Usually if you put the character in a pose, that might be their, like, overseas, if they don't have time, they might just stick them in that pose, so it might not fit with what's going on in the scene.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
But when I am drawing them for myself or for boards, you do have to be aware of how the character would act in that situation. Like, like the whole ice cream thing. Like, if Raven was eating it, she probably could not, you know, she'd just be like, this is good, I guess. You know, like, she's not gonna...
That was actually a pretty good Raven. Whereas with Beast Boy, it'd be a very different thing too, right?
He'd be hyper and probably have it on his head or something. Or would fall on the ground and he would turn into something like a dog that can't eat stuff off the ground anyway.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. See,
I just had this image of a Beast Boy and Starfire just like going to town, like on a gallon or one of those like 5 gallon things of ice cream.
And it's going to be a gross flavor, too.
Yeah.
Speaking of, like, gross ice cream flavors. The first year I went to Japan during Christmas, we went through this place called Namja Town, which is all this cat themes. But they have a section where it's all these, like, hundreds of different flavors of ice cream. And I went with some of my friends at work. And they decided they were going to buy all the weird versions. They bought, like, beef tongue ice cream. Ice cream, squid ice cream. I can't remember all of them.
Oh, Dan lit up at that.
Dan loves some squid.
Yes, he does.
I love me the squid, yeah.
I mean, actually, a lot of those guys were board artists on Teen Titans that I was with. So, like, oh, come on, Brianne, try it. And I'm like, no, it's okay. I'm just going to eat my, like, awesome, like, pecan ice cream. You guys color beef tongue.
You didn't even try them?
I did try the beef tongue, and, like, this is my gross analogy. Like, you know when you go to a barbecue and then you eat your food and there's still, like, a layer of meat and then there's not enough place and they just throw another vanilla scoop on there?
Uh-huh.
So
that's what it tastes like.
Oh, it's, like, weird.
Oh, Brianne, you're so Raven.
Oh, boy. Nicely done, Paul. This Paul story moment was brought to you by Geritol. But I want to hear from Dan now on this.
Speaking of Geritol.
I want to hear from Dan on this emotional honesty thing. Like, how do you get to this? Like, because, we spent so much time talking about this in the past and the different stories we tried to develop, right? Is how do we get to what the character's honesty is? And what does that even mean?
You know, it seems to me that all of us have a tendency to tell stories that we've heard before or read before. We fit them into, you know, categories. I go into classrooms and I'll talk with kids about writing and about stories they might want to tell. And you'll often hear stories that have already been published, essentially, or pieces of them, because they're influenced, and it's great, and they tell them with enthusiasm, and that's really wonderful. But I think even when we're, you know, allegedly professionals, we're drawing on all of those things, and we're using the old tropes, and we're telling the stories we've told before, and it turns out to be very hard to have your character react as herself or himself to the particular thing that they are facing right at that moment. Because we have all this stored up, well, this is what would happen. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about the emotional honesty in a character, it's for the storyteller, it's resisting the path of least resistance, I guess. It's saying really what is going to happen now. Why would Amy Winston become, you know, somebody, a character out of Dungeons and Dragons who's grown up in the Forgotten Realms when she grew up in Hudson, New York, right? She shouldn't. You have characters who suddenly speak in bad Elizabethan dialogue because somebody thinks that that's supposed to happen. And really, that character would be saying, "What the?" Or yeah, whatever.
Right.
You know, make your character, believe that your character is a real character is the biggest thing I can say about Jersey's question. Believe that your character is a real character. They're not you, or at least not entirely you. They're not all those other characters that you've read. Integrity. Let them really be who they are. Let that drive what happens. Sometimes you have to change the impetus that they're responding to because, you know, you thought it would get the response that would lead you wherever the story needed to go. But you know what? This character wouldn't respond that way. So you better back up and give them something else to react to. Because if they're not reacting as them, you're losing your audience, really.
And you have to spend a lot of time ahead of time kind of thinking about what they are, who they are. You know, that's sometimes people want to rush into the story. You know, when they're starting a project, they're like, oh, I got to get to the story. And they're not necessarily taking the time to think what makes this character unique. What, you know, they get the general idea and then they start to run off with it. But like you say, to know how your character is going to react, you have to dig into that character to start with and really
build.
Right,
and sometimes you have to write it wrong first. Sometimes you can dive into the story for a while, and then you go for a while and you say, you know what? Now I know who the character is. I'm going to start over. One of my teachers, the writer Kate Wilhelm, talked about that, about how, you know, you may think you know where your story begins, but you might really go for a long time before you find yourself at the place where the story really begins, because you have finally figured that stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
So you can figure it out by thinking about it, or you can figure it out by writing it. But ultimately, you have to be willing to throw out a lot of stuff if you take the second approach, figuring it out by writing it.
Right. Brianne, how many attempts does it take to get a really good set of storyboards? Oh, I felt that.
Wow.
I felt that sigh.
For me, it takes a lot. Like, I feel like storyboarding is definitely not my strongest muscle. I didn't start boarding professionally until a couple of years ago because I could not find design work, and there was a lull in the animation business a little bit. So that's actually why I started on Brave and the Bold. They were short on board artists, and Michael Chang, who I worked with on Titans, decided to bring me on and kind of train me and help me. So I really cut my teeth on Brave and the Bold. Like, but it would take me, I would try to do 4 or 5 passes of thumbnails before I would finalize on a board. I would turn it to my director, and it, like, he had so many revisions for me because, like, I was learning everything. You know, like, and it was such a quick, speedy deadline. When I did the first board for Amethyst, and I think, how many times did I redo that? I can't even remember.
I mean, what are you redoing? It's like, because, you know, there's people in the chat who are listening really hard right now because they are very interested in storyboarding. Is it a drawing them right kind of thing? Is it a viewing angle thing? Is it, moment choice thing? What are you redoing when you're doing multiple passes?
For me, it's just trying to figure out where everything goes. And it's almost like juggling, like, because you'll get a script and, you know, they might say, like, fight happens here in warehouse with Barrel or something, and epic fight. But, and it might just be one little paragraph, but that fight might need to go on for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, and you have to figure out, flush things out. And the other thing, too, is the amount of characters. Like, if it's just, like, one or two, oh, that's fine. But, like, I know on Brave and the Bold, and luckily, like, they didn't give me too many fight scenes since I was still fairly new. But you'd have, like, 5 or 6 characters. You have to keep track of them all. You know, you have to also think, like, you know, if there's the Flash, like, you have to take into consideration what their powers are. Like, how are you going to take out this character? And, you know, if there's any plot points. I feel bad. I feel like somebody else would, like, Day of Leave or somebody would probably have a better way to explain it. But
no, but what you're describing, it sounds to me like you're saying that you have to, you're kind of acting as an agent in the actual execution of the story and thinking about if the Flash
is...
You have to act for the characters, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, let's say you take the Flash from Justice League Unlimited, and so the Wally West Flash, the good Flash, as it turned out. Oh, no, he didn't. I love Wally West. But anyway, so how's he going to disarm Lex Luthor as differently than, say, John Stewart Green
with
Lantern?
With his charm?
Well, John Stewart Green Lantern is an uptight Marine, right? And then Wally West is way more laid back, and he always has to have some kind of panache to what he does. So you got to figure that into the acting moment. You got to figure in, like, you know, what is the viewing angle? Am I going to look at it from down low? Am I going to look at it from up high? Lex Luthor walks into the room, and he's very menacing. Okay, well, I'm going to look down at him. Why doesn't he not look menacing? Right?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to look up at him now. Oh, and suddenly he looks menacing. Oh, I'm going to rim light him. I'm going to put some light behind him. Now all of a sudden he looks even more menacing. Why are you making that face at me, Paul?
I'm just fascinated.
Oh, because I'm on a tear. Yeah. But anyway, so like, there's a lot of moment choices that go on in here, whether you use your viewing angle. And then also in storyboarding, this is where it gets really interesting, is in comics, it's static. In storyboarding, now you get to do panning and trucking and zooming and figuring out, okay, we're going to start here on Beast Boy's hand holding the flower. And we're going to zoom out to show that he's standing on a junk heap offering the flower to somebody, right?
I mean, a lot of subtle acting and other things that you can add that just will tip off the viewer with more what's going on. Like things that, like, the dialogue might say this, but you could do something to give it more meaning.
I want to hear from Dan on that. I mean, in terms of like how the dialogue marries with the images as well. I mean, now we're getting into like general storytelling stuff.
General storytelling, is he in your new project with Dan?
Yeah,
general storytelling, yes. he's the villain. I need to digress for just a moment because something was suddenly making me think. We were talking about these characters. How would this character do that, et cetera, if it's this character against Lex Luthor or whatever. So I really have to give credit to someone who you normally don't think of as gets credit for great characterization, but I'm going to give credit to Julie Schwartz, who is thought of as a plot guy, totally a plot guy. But one thing Julie said to me when he was asking me to do a Superboy story was, the plot for a Superboy story can't be a plot that would work in a Superman story.
Huh.
Oh. Yeah, right. You know, so that idea that you really are talking about different characters who are operating out of themselves came from, really, of all people, Julie Schwartz. And I love Julie, so I don't want to sound like I'm disparaging him. But, you know, he really was this kind of crazy idea factory in a lot of ways. But he really did understand how characters work. Maybe didn't understand dialogue entirely. He changed one of my jokes in a Superman story. I will never forgive him for that. But
he's not bitter, and that's what's important.
Go back to DC Comics Presents number 51, and you will find a baseball joke. And the baseball joke that I had was funnier than the one Julie decided to replace it with. But that's okay. So... dialogue, and you know one of the things about writing dialogue, so I keep coming back to this word integrity, right? And I think that's what we're all talking about, Brianne. I think it's really what you're talking about too, is that the keeping it real approach, but also the idea, and Jersey and I have talked about this a lot, that anything you do is serving the story. The story that's supposed to be the sort of the platonic story that you're trying to get to as nearly as you can. You know, if you stop to show how clever you are as a writer of dialogue, or if you stop to show what a beautiful line you have in, you know, or what amazing detail or curlicue or whatever you can produce and wow somebody as a technical feat as an artist, you are throwing away the real job.
Oh man, I got to jump on this because this is like this thing where these days, like, so many people think the effort has to show. I was once talking on another podcast. I was guesting on somebody else's podcast, and I brought up that Amethyst page that I always use in my classrooms. It's from Amethyst Princess of Gemworld issue 2. It's page 5, I think. It's Citrina is using a spell to turn Granch and all the other guards into trees. And Ernie Colone did this thing where Dan's gone
to get it.
I'm looking for it.
Either that, or you know, he might have to take a little break.
I'm pretty sure it's issue 2. Anyway, he does this thing where he Ernie Colone used panel 3 and panel 5 with one image. He managed to make one image into two panels in the story by this different kind of trickery that you can do in comics. And I love using it in classrooms because it's what I consider to be an example of pure comics. No other medium can accomplish that. Use one moment for two moments, right? Mm-hmm. And as I'm showing it to these guys on this comics podcast, one of them goes, "Boy, it's just too bad he doesn't do very good backgrounds, huh?" And I was like, really? That's what you're going to get hung up on, is that in panel 1, there's no background. There's just a wash of color. Because I'm like, does that matter? Well, we know where they are.
And so often when you get the hyper-detailed backgrounds, I mean, you know, people think, oh.
There it is on the screen. Dan's putting up. Can you hold it steady, Dan?
I'm a little too old to hold things steady, but I'll try.
And there's a bubble yum ad next to it.
Can you...
I'll put a link to it in the show notes as well. But yeah, there it is, the page of Granch getting
turned into a tree.
And so he's responding to Citrina in panel 2, but then we see the dialogue continuing into panel 6 or panel 5 or whatever, where Carnelian is taunting Citrina as the guards are all being rooted to the ground. That's why
the dialogue is going in and out of panels.
I know.
Right.
God, it's such a great example.
So that it's very fluid in a way. And Jersey, as you and I have discussed, I don't recall that either Ernie or I, and I was writing the first pass at the dialogue on these, I don't recall that either Ernie or I stopped for a moment to say, how is this technically working as story flow?
Oh, you could drop
it
out, Dan.
Responding to each other and making it work.
Right, right. Well, I mean, that's just it. It's like when you're in the moment and doing the creative work, and I'm sure all you guys can back me up on this, you're just in the zone and just doing it. And it's only after the fact we back up and go, oh, and you look at it with like a cooler eye and go, hey, the kid was onto something there. But when you're just doing it, you're not magically just say, I'm going to defy traditional reading direction today. You know, you're just trying to solve a problem whenever you're working on the page. And then that's where the creativity happens, right?
You know, and I think that going back to the question about storyboarding, which I can't do, but, you know, as you talk about it, Brianna, as I talk about this particular page in Amethyst, and as you have people who are wondering, well, gee, how do I do that? And how you do that is really do versions of it over and over again until you have these techniques in your bag of tricks that really are second nature, that you don't have to think about. They're just there, and you've iterated and reiterated so many times, it just comes, and it's the next thing to do.
Isn't this what musicians and dancers and athletes do all the time?
Well, that's a very common thing. My writing professor, my favorite writing professor in college, said, and he was quoting somebody too, it's like, you got a million mistakes, you might as well get them out of the way.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I keep a sketchbook. I draw on it every day. I go through like a sketchbook a month. Mm. And experience-wise, like when I started on Brave and the Bold, The board that I did for Amethyst, it wouldn't have been at that quality if I hadn't been doing boards the last couple of years, because I've learned so much since then. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the whole thing with the stuff being so short, you have to problem solve. Like, well, how can I fit this in here? But I need this to happen. Well, maybe I can combine these two. And then it ends up being like, okay, that actually worked pretty cool. And I know some of my friends who helped with some of the other boards and stuff, we all had to problem solve. Like, we all talk to each other just to keep track and to if anyone needed any help or figure anything out. So there was a lot of cases where we had to kind of combine elements. It's kind of hard, huh, to explain without showing. I can't show anything. But
well, maybe with any luck. With any luck, we can actually get you to come out for our Kids Read Comics celebration. And then you could teach us how you do it by showing us in person.
And an actual
workshop?
That
would be great. And for those who were, I guess, are just watching Brianne speak, Paul and Jersey and I were nodding very vigorously
yeah,
the whole time that you were saying that stuff, because that experience is very familiar.
Well, guess what, guys? We are on to book recommendations segment. We're going to close in the next couple minutes here. And the AADL Ninja quietly crept into the room. You guys didn't hear him coming. Oh, your mic's not live. We'll see if we can get Matt in the. Okay, right. Matt just notified us that Eli is live and direct.
That's how much of a ninja I was. That microphone turned itself off in deference to me.
By the way, somebody earlier said, "Oh, you know, Eli's coming," and I'm like, "Oh, so we have to
hide your heart now."
Hide your heart, girl.
Everybody went, "What?"
Right.
You see how rapidly he responded to that, Paul? Which means that was another Geritol moment for Paul's story, everybody.
Also, I get, you know, you got that.
Right.
I have all the story jokes.
Yes, of course.
My entire life. So I was sympathetic there.
Well, let me state that I only know about the Eli's Coming song because of people from other generations continually throwing it in my face.
Didn't you see the great episode of Sports Night?
Is this something I'd need to own a TV to understand? No, just kidding. No. I've heard Sports Night is a great show.
All right, so Eli, I know Eli's got a lot to add to this discussion and recommend a few things.
I do, and you know, as I've been listening to the conversation today, there's so much great stuff, and you know, I have two girls who read comics in my life. My wife is a big comics fan, and my 6-year old daughter is also a big comics fan. And to me, the only thing you have to do to make comics work for girls is not have superheroes in them. That's like, I mean, girls aren't interested in power fantasies. You know, that's the thing that I really found. And, you know, it's like that the storylines, the conventions of superhero comics, I mean, and not to say that there isn't a female audience for superhero comics, but like when you think about why do comics not always resonate with a mainstream girl audience, you know, there are plenty of comics that do. They just don't have fantasies in them.
We didn't even talk about manga this whole time. I'm surprised we didn't bring up manga.
I've got a couple here in my list.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, part of it is just, and, you know, I also learned a lot about this from the Pokemon stuff that we would do at the library. You know, the boys would all be like, oh, fire defeats this. You know, they'd throw out these really huge overpowered Pokemon. They'd get their butt kicked because they didn't know the type matchups. The girls would have a much more nuanced view as to which Pokemon were really going to work. They didn't go for the big, powerful, flashy moves, and they would often win. So, you know, it was an interesting juxtaposition. But as a result, I brought just a few book recommendations from our collection that I actually decided not to be limited by stuff that was actually on the shelf. So I brought a couple things just to kind of semi-show on my iPad. However, this is all on the web at aedl.org/go/girlcomics. And so that's a shortcut to this list that I made. So one of them, this is my daughter's favorite book. Not sure if it shows up on the camera there. It's called Toys in the Basement. It's by Blanquette with a Q, B-L-A-N-Q-U-E-T. And it's not shelved as a graphic novel because it's in that great area of kids graphic novels that librarians don't consider to be graphic novels. You know what I mean? Like, you know, Captain Underpants what's the other thing? The Ook and Gluck, the caveman thing, you know, where it's like, yes, they're totally graphic novels in form, but they're not always, you know, they're shelved often with the rest of the fiction.
I ran into that. My last recommendation was for Allison Dare. And I found it shelved at my local library in just the juvenile fiction section. I was like, because I was like looking through the graphic novels saying, oh, it said that it was in, but
and where is it?
Yeah, looking in the wrong place.
So this is a book called Toys in the Basement.
And it is totally a graphic novel, completely in form, beautifully hand-painted. And what's really interesting about this, it is a super dark story. I mean, and it's, you know, it's like Sid's House, you know? I mean, it's Sid's House without the sadist present.
But it's the same
sort of like, ooh, there's something wrong in this home. Somebody's escaping to a world to get away from something. But it's for kids. It's my six-year-old girl's favorite book. Despite the darkness and sort of like the, you know, the, what's that called? Hylozoism, the belief that everything has a spirit. You know, like, and it's the Toy Story thing, which I don't know about you guys. It's made a lot harder for me to throw away toys in my house. Thinking about, you know, oh man, it's gonna be in the incinerator teary-eyed someday.
Oh man.
So this is Toys in the Basement. I recommend this highly. It's a really, really fantastic book. The other one that I wanted to be sure to mention is a nonfiction graphic novel. It's written by a woman. Illustrated is by Brooke Gladstone. It's the influencing machine, Brooke Gladstone on the media. And if you haven't read this, this is one of the most fantastic nonfiction graphic novels I've ever read, and I've read a lot of them. And this is, you know, Brooke Gladstone is the host of NPR's On the Media, and this is her first comic project. And as a media pundit, she took it extremely seriously to understand the form. And she's working with an artist. I can't remember. Josh Neufeld is the artist who she worked with. And, you know, he would tell her the limitations of what he could realistically pull off in the time frame. But basically, this is about how media influences culture and culture influences media, and it has some really horrific stories in there. Not like, just as far as like ways in which the media has inadvertently changed history. Like, for example, the report about Hitler's rise to power and an interview with a former World War I general from Germany, that if it had been published by the right newspaper, would have been seen all over the world and could have prevented Hitler's rise to power. You know, I mean, that kind of like what if sort of, you know, what's the historical fiction inspiring sort of stuff.
Alternate universe.
That's right. Yeah. So Brooke Gladstone, The Influencing Machine, that's another one. Now, on the flip side, and this is in the non-superhero department, this is definitely the kind of like, I'd call it, you know, the girl cash-in kind of comics. This is Baby Mouse, which is a series that's
fairly
popular. I mean, it does a lot of sales. It's very, you were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, make it look like it's worth your time. Baby Mouse doesn't look like it's worth its time. It's very quickly put together. You know, it's marker lines. It has a very kind of...
It doesn't look strained, right?
No.
It doesn't look like there's, like what Dan was talking about earlier, this kind of like the let me show you what a genius I am with a pen.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And the stories are very simple, but they're also pretty well calculated to appeal to really young girls, 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's, I mean, yes, this is Cupcake Tycoon, so there's a little bit of a power fantasy going on in there, but it's also a, it's a really nicely put together little series. It's light fare, and... Clearly, the executives involved made sure there was pink on the cover. And this reminds me of the story of why Princess Celestia toy is pink. Do you guys know about this story?
Oh, I do not. Okay. And I was wondering about this.
All right. So, you know, Princess Celestia is a white horse. This is, you know, indisputable fact.
Yep.
Right?
Okay. Watch the show.
Honestly, prettier like that, too.
Definitely.
My personal taste.
Well, and, you know, white horses are something amazing.
Yeah.
Pink horses are everywhere, you know, and it's not like there isn't already a pink horse on the show, you know. I mean, there is a pink horse on the show. Her name is Pink.
Pinkie Pie,
yeah. You know. So anyway, I was finally trying to find out because my daughter would ask me this question. Why is the Princess Celestia toy pink? That's stupid. You know, and it's like, I don't know, baby. So, of course, like, you know, if all you have to do is Google, why is Princess Celestia pink? And you find a forum where Lauren's saying, you know, that's beyond my reach. Yeah. And she said that the manufacturer, basically, that was solely on feedback from the retailers. The retailers said, if it's pink, it'll sell. If it's white, it won't. Make it pink or we won't buy it.
Oh,
so, you know, I'm sure that there's the book buying equivalent with the cover of Baby Mouse making that the same case. Yeah. And then, you know, I mean, of course, Bone is legendary. But what's interesting about Bone is that it has an unbelievably strong female character who is not... you know, for girls by design. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think Jeff Smith set out, I'm going to write a comic for girls.
That's a good example of something where you can clearly tell that he wasn't saying, this is my target audience.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Right. It just so happens that he wrote a really strong, realistic female character who also has a power fantasy. You know, I mean, she gets really powerful toward the end of the comic.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was always interesting to me how much the girls in my life, both my wife and daughter, were into Bone because of it not being, it didn't require as much suspension of disbelief, you know, because these weren't human people doing human things, or they weren't all humans, you know. Mm-hmm. And it just was such a compelling story. I mean, even before we had kids, we were buying Bone every issue, you know. We weren't even waiting for the trade paperbacks. But what's most interesting about the way that my daughter reads comics is that what she's really into right now are the cinemanga versions of all the Miyazaki films. Hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, where they take stills from the film and then recobble it together in comic
form. Yeah, and you know, as a comics person, you're like, what the hell is this? Yeah. You know, this is, how much of a cash-in could this be? But for her, she can take the time over the story that the movie doesn't give her. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, that's one of the things where I get really excited about comics as a medium, is that the reader gets to be a participant in the pacing of the story. Dan and I have argued in the past about whether or not we are in control as the authors, and we do have a certain degree of control, but ultimately we don't have full control because the reader can zoom back, forth, all over the place. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the things.
The job is to manipulate the reader as much as we can.
Right. Excellent.
Whereas with film, and I once had two film buffs really give me a hard time about this, and I said that as opposed to film, which is, in my opinion, more of a passive experience because you're not in control of what you're seeing at any given time. But anyway, yeah, so continue. So these cinemangas.
So, you know, and the thing that's, and of course, I mean, I kind of consider Miyazaki as the gold standard of female characters. I mean, none of his movies, well, some of them are kind of, Kiki's Delivery Service, you could say, is for girls. You know, mm-hmm. but it's not exclusive. You
no
know
way.
I mean,
when Tombo's hanging from that blimp at the end, I'm right there on the edge of the seat with everybody else. And when everything goes silent just before that big moment, oh man, it gets me every time.
And what I love about that is then the movie's over.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, here's the climax. All right, thanks, credits. And in all of his movies, you know. Yeah. But I mean, and especially the way that he's so... We just saw Arrietty. Have you guys seen Arrietty
yet? I haven't
seen
it yet.
So, you know, to digress into movies a little bit, but, you know, it's very similar to a lot of his films in that it's a coming-of-age story that is shown and not told. You know what I mean? And and especially, you think about that in Kiki, like the one scene where she's walking down the street and she sees the older, slightly older girls looking in the window and laughing.
Yeah.
It's like, there's nothing said about what she's feeling.
Right.
You know? It's just, you just understand that. And all that stuff. And I think that that's really the stuff that resonates with my daughter, is seeing, because these are, even the witch is a more human character than anyone in most of the media properties that she's being exposed to.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Kiki's got problems that almost nobody on TV ever has. And it's really, you know, she's like not sure of her place in the world. How many shows are about that?
Right.
You know?
Well, Perfect Strangers. Hey.
That's right.
It's more like
bulky as metaphor.
Yeah, right.
Aren't we all a little bit like bulky?
A little.
No, Dan, I think you could speak to this in the chat here. Cartoon Funtime is saying, I never liked superhero adult male-oriented comics because the art wasn't full of appealing shapes, accessible character designs, etc. Man, did we not just have a discussion with somebody about whether or not a certain story that we may or may not be developing would benefit from having a more cartoony style, given that we want it to appeal to girls?
Oh yeah, no, that's definitely right. It's the, you know, so Eli, I take a little issue with the idea that superhero stories are all about the kind of power fantasy that you're talking about.
Sure.
I think they're very often, and when they're at their best, they're about a fantasy of how you decide what to do when you have power, which is a very different kind of story. I think of that again now because that off-putting nature of some of this superhero art is exactly that. It is about raw and almost ugly power, and bursting with power unmediated by emotion, morality, intelligence, or anything like that, right? So that's why what we'll call a cartoony or a Bigfoot style, I think, is going to have the kind of appeal, or at least it's going to avoid that kind of off-putting nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, like the new Shazam design, the Captain Marvel design. I don't know if anybody's seen that yet.
I haven't seen it.
No, it's the new Shazam design.
It's the new Shazam, and he's
once again, now we've created a hero who can't say his own name.
Somebody took his Malox, and he's really upset about it.
I don't know why he's all crouched in a corner.
Yeah, that drawing's hard because I can't really see what's going on in that, too. It's so much of it's dark. Like, you can't see his face. So I'm kind of like, okay, he's got a hood, so maybe there's more going on and that we're not seeing.
Yeah.
It's all in the gamma, right?
Well, it's not CC Beck, huh?
No, it's not, unfortunately. But, you know, and different times, I guess. But anyway, I want to wrap this up because, you know, the Ann Arbor District Library spends a lot of money to put this show on, and I want to be respectful of their resources. Gosh, we will have to get this roundtable back together again in the future
I think that's great.
Oh, okay.
Maybe,
I was agreeing with you.
In the fall after Amethyst gets re-released.
Well, and
I think by then, hopefully some of the shorts would have aired by then too.
Well, we'll also talk about seeing if you would be available in July to come out for Kids Read Comics, Brianne. I think that would be awesome.
Are we going
to
do a live kid comics are great from the?
Probably.
Yeah, excellent.
I think we'd be doing some live broadcasting from that. So
yeah, but Brianne should definitely come out.
Yes, Brianne, we'll talk. Anybody who wants to talk with Brianne can find her at potatofarmgirl.blogspot.com. You also have a portfolio site. It's just BrianneDrewHard.com.
While and there's stuff missing, so I apologize if someone goes there and they're like, what is going on with this site? Like, it's my friend like that really well. I haven't had time to update it. So,
well, but for more timely updates, they can follow you on Twitter at Potato Farm Girl, right?
Twitter's probably the best to ask me questions at, actually.
Yeah,
because it's so fast and immediate,
it's easier to respond.
I'm following Brianne now.
And she's following you?
Yes.
But yeah, it is easier to address fan questions that way because it is so short and it's limited and you don't have to worry about writing a novel.
I was going to say, but limit them to, not the, now this multi-part question.
Yeah, no, none of that stuff. Just ask a simple question if you want to ask. Or just tell her that you really liked seeing her on the Comics Are Great show so then she'll come back.
It's probably better than emailing me because I'm really behind on emails right now. I know people have been asking me questions and I just don't. Like, this week, I think my life is going to start going back to normal.
What's that like?
Been really busy.
No, I'm the worst at email. I'm right there with you. So
you are. But really, really are.
No, I am. Yeah. I admit it freely to the public.
It's like if you want to get, I have to direct message you to get
yes.
get responses.
It's easier to get in touch with me via Twitter. I suck at email. So
well, email's how you talk to old people. So, I mean, that's...
Again!
Yeah.
Again!
I noticed that Paul's emails are always in all caps and there's no punctuation.
so not true. especially the punctuation part offends me deeply.
Sorry.
Because I'm one of those people going like, really?
12 commas?
You couldn't hit the shift.
Yeah.
And plus I'm like the king of parentheticals.
But Brianne, thank you very much for making time to be here because she's on the West Coast and so she had to get up early for this and I really, really appreciate you doing that for us.
I have to go to work soon.
Yeah.
Work? Oh, no.
But then I want to turn to Dan Mishkin. The best place to find him is facebook.com/DanMishkin, right?
That's the best place to see my collection of Superman toys, yes.
Yes. the man has a Superman-themed bathroom, and when I saw it, I came home and I told my wife, I want a Cybertron-themed bathroom so bad after seeing Dan's Superman bathroom.
With yellow, red, and blue tiles.
Yep.
Yeah. You're saying he's flush with Superman memorabilia.
Oy, here we go.
Oh.
But Dan, thank you. What's that, Brianne?
I said, I want a themed bathroom, too.
Well, tell you what, come back to Kids Read Comics in July, and we'll show you the bathroom.
We'll all go see Dan's bathroom.
That'll be the
field trip.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bathroom, take photos.
And then we have Paul Story, Storyville.com. Thank you for lending your voice to the conversation and being with me.
My pleasure.
And for all of
Storyville on the Twitters.
Storyville on the Twitters as well. And Dan Mishkin on the Twitters. And then Eli, I'll miss you most of all. Ulotricus on Twitter. Ulotricus online. Ulo.trico.us. There we go. And at comics.aadl.org for any other things that you need to make a mention of going on the library. Cool. Well, thanks for letting us do this longer show today, too.
No
appreciate
problem.
So thanks, everybody, for listening and watching. This show was streamed live at comicsaregreat.tv at Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And it will be collected later as a podcast at comicsaregreat.com and comics.aadl.org. Comics.aadl.org. That's where you can get the video podcast feed if you want to watch the videos after the fact. So check it out there. And thanks, everybody, in the chat. Until next time, I've been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye.